This is Godfrey, Dog Holden, recorded at the Marguerite Bay Reunion, Bowness on Windermere, by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th and 31st of October, 2010. Dog Holden, Part 2. What happened to your psychology over that winter?
I found it very trying. I don't think I cracked up. I probably got a bit short-tempered. Although I've perhaps always been a bit short-tempered anyway. But I don't think I went into serious decline. It'd be interesting to see what other people think about it, or what Phil or you thought about it. But I was very upset. I was upset not just about being stuck, but the way that we've been stuck. I didn't sit there, you know, blaming anybody or blaming Bass or blaming the Russians. I just couldn't grasp the series of events. I couldn't understand how it was that all this had happened. Perhaps that's a bit silly when you think about the Antarctic and all the events that can happen there. Other people might say, well, of course you get stuck in the Antarctic, that's what it's all about. But up to then, things had gone so well. I suppose you could say that I was more affected because by then I'd met my future wife. And so I was supposed to be going back to see her, she was my girlfriend at the time. And although I wasn't engaged to be married at that time, it was quite a serious relationship. And so the expectation of going back to see her, and so the disappointment, that the unexpected disappointment. Again, one might say, well, you signed on to go to the Antarctic. So that was it. I'd actually signed on to go back before I met her. I then met her. She was heading out from England to the United States to work, which is what she wanted to do and what she did in fact go and do. And I went off to the Antarctic. But the idea was that we'd get together after I'd come back for a year, whether that be in the States or wherever it was. So, and the day she found out via a message from her brother, the FID, who'd left by then, that I was stuck, was the day she found out her mother had died. So it was a fairly traumatic situation for her. So I was very, very guilty about that. And the fact that after three brilliant, interesting winters with FIDs and all that meant, the contrast with that, that was all extremely difficult. So when I said before the books kept me alive, that was true mentally, because it gave us something to go for, as well as the crazy physical work kept us going during the day. And
so the psychology of the three Englishmen and the psychology of the Argentinians was somewhat different, was it?
Because of
the expectations.
Yes.
You both had different expectations.
That's right.
You both had.
That's right. And I wouldn't want to put Phil and Youth in the same pot as I was. As I said, they had different circumstances, and certainly Phil was much more sanguine about it, and Youth was to a considerable extent. I was the one, I did take responsibility for it. I couldn't understand, I must have cocked up somewhere along the line. But the Argentinians, they wanted to be there. They planned to be there. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you learn any Spanish?
I did. I learned good Spanish. Or actually, that's wrong. I learned bad Spanish. I learned Argentinians. South Americans do speak good Spanish, but it was Argentinian. It was army slang.
Yeah.
It was army Antarctic slang, and it was very what they would call porteño, which is Buenos Aires slang. Porteño is the lingo they speak around the port, which is the rough area where all the bars and the brothels are. So that's the real, real rough area. So when I speak Argentinian to my friends, perfectly understandable, but they all laugh because I've got these ridiculous accents and all these weird slangy words, some of which they recognise and some of which they've never heard, just like the FIDs have got their own glossary. So I had a good ear, and I worked quite hard at it in speaking it, and it stood me in very good stead. It stuck well with me. So that was the upside. The other way I passed my time, apart from the reading, was I played the tin whistle. So one of the first phrases I learned was, Puedo tocar mi flautista, may I play my whistle? I used to have to ask the cook, because while everybody else was gonking, sleeping after dinner, after lunch, because they used to have a protracted Latin lunch, which went on for a long time. So they'd all go off gonking, and I'd go and play my whistle while the cook was making supper. But to say the time dragged would be the understatement of the year. That time still drags with me today. I still look back on the time, not each individual, there were great people and everything, but I still look up on that drag time as a huge, great, prolonged period of horror. It was really, really difficult. It was endless. I mean, 9.5 months is a long time even now, or at any stage of life. But it loomed ahead, and it never got any closer. And whereas some things get shorter in when you look back at them and you forget about the bad times, that never does with me. It is still the full 9.5 months, and it still feels exactly like that.
It was a prison sentence, was it?
It was a real prison sentence, and I haven't forgotten any of it whatsoever.
When you heard about 3 months ago about the Chilean miners on the news that they were incarcerated, what were your thoughts that day when you heard the news?
I thought very much of our experience. Obviously felt for the guys, and of course they were in a much more mortal danger than we were. But many of the feelings will have been the same, many of them. And I was very tempted when they were rescued, which was the most brilliant feat of engineering and everything else and human endeavour. I was very tempted to send an email to youth and saying, nobody sent a capsule down for us. Lucky guys, they got out after 69 days. We were there for 9.5 months. So I wouldn't in any... There were similarities, definitely. In the mental state, not necessarily in the physical, other than that they were underground and we were, but...
We were all very excited when they did come out, but would you have been even more excited than me?
Yes, I was. I felt very much I understood them, and I would think they would have understood me and the feeling that they had of that release and going back to the loved ones and all of that. It was the day that the planes came over for me. Although even then things got quite difficult after that about getting home. But that was the most wonderful day I could ever
imagine. Well, tell me how you got away.
Well, I mean, we actually got away. Finally, when the planes got down from Canada, as they used to do, and arrived at Rothera, it was simply a mechanical thing of finding good weather at each end. And again, we had to wait for a few days about that. And the plane came over and picked us up.
This would be a twin otter?
It was a twin otter, and Giles Kershaw made absolutely certain that he was the pilot. I mean, there was only two, and he was the senior, but he knew what we were at, because he knew the base, and he made sure that he was the one who came and picked us up. And we went up to Halley to deliver the mail, and we had a couple of nights there and a party, and then we actually flew back to Belgrano again, because we needed to refuel before hopping over to the Weddell Sea. So we three of us went back to Rothera. The Argentinians were sorry to see us go, and they wanted us to stay, do the full term, because by then the summer period and the relief ship was only a few months away, and they wanted us to stay and see it out and go back to Buenos Aires with them. But anyway, we went back to Rothera, and the other two guys, Phil and Youth, they'd not done a summer at Rothera on Marguerite Bay. So they were keen to stay there and do that and wait for the ship out. And I was keen. I'd done plenty of summers at Marguerite Bay. And summer to me meant being in the field. So I'd already got approval from the Argentinians to get a lift from their air base in the north of the Antarctic Peninsula, Marambio base, and get a lift back from there. But we were spawned again with several weeks of bad weather between the two. And when Giles finally got me off the ground at Rothera, we flew up through a hole in the cloud with ice forming on the wings, so we only just made it. And when we finally got to Marambio base, a few hundred miles away north, the C-130 was stood on the tarmac there, well, on the gravel, and its engines were going, and I jumped out of a twin otter and ran across it and jumped into the Hercules, and we took off. So even that was touch and go.
Who is Colonel Cow? Or what is Colonel Cow?
Coronel Vaca. The plane had already picked up. They'd picked up by helicopter and brought to Morambio an outgoing wintering team of Argentinians from their base at the very northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, which is called Esperanza, same name as the camp for the gold miners, which means hope. It also means waiting, by the way, hope and waiting. So Esperanza base was at Hope Bay, as the British would call us. And this was the first winter they'd had when they'd really gone for it in terms of making a solid, very solid political and socio-political claim on the Antarctic. So they'd put in not just soldiers or scientists, they'd put in women, nothing unusual about that now, but it was then, a married couple, and the lady was pregnant so that the child could be born on base, so that was quite a statement of occupation, an engaged couple, a priest who could marry them, so that was quite another good sign that this was Argentinian territory and there were people living there, and a family unit already, so they had this complete mixture of people who'd been sort of planted there to make these statements. And this poor chap, Colonel Vaca, is Colonel Cow, and he was the base commander. And he was the most relieved, he was probably as relieved as I was, but I sat next to him in the hold of the C-130 on the flight back to Rio Gallegos and then to Buenos Aires, and I had a good chat with him. I had enough Spanish to get by then. And I was a base commander, an ex-base commander as well. So he said it was the most desperate experience. And he was a colonel in the army, so he was used to commanding troops of people. And he said it was the most desperate experience he'd had in his life. He said it was an absolute disaster, all of this. The social tensions and the difficulties about all these people who didn't really want to be there. They were just a social experiment. And so it was a nightmare. And he was, you know, visibly relieved to be finally leaving this place. So he and I both, although for slightly different reasons. So I always think of Colonel Cow here. Because the major in charge of Belgrano was Major Papa, which means several things. Pope, father, but it also means potato. So us Brits used to call him Major Potato. Yes.
There's one little detail we've missed, I think, or I may be wrong, but there's a note here about checking stores at Belgrano. In case a war broke out between the Argentinians and the Chileans.
Yes, well...
Is that true?
Yes, it was. Many will remember a lot of tensions between those two nations over claims for the islands around Cape Horn. This was not just a claim about an island. It actually had... It has major effect on their claims for their slice of Antarctica, which overlap with the British. The British claim it on "We Discovered It First" or something like that. The Argentinians and the Chileans both claim it on the extension of their lines, the lines of latitude which border their countries. And if you run those lines down, sorry, longitude, if you run those lines down to the pole, they clearly take a slice, a sector. And so where your islands are can shift those lines of longitude considerably. So it meant quite a lot to them. And there have been many spats about this in the past, but they came very, very close to war in late-ish autumn, British autumn, 1978. And so this was a military base. And so we went on full standby, bizarre as it may seem. And so we had to do an inventory of all the stores. And the icebreaker wasn't going to be able to come down to relieve them because the countries really did come very close. As it so happened, this was diffused because an emissary of the Pope came down and both sides agreed that he could adjudicate on the issue. In fact, the adjudication on the critical island fell to the Chileans. And I suppose you could say to their credit, the Argentinians have abided by that ever since. So we didn't go to war. But we were used on FIDS to have, you know, plenty of food, basic food in those days, lots of tinned and dried and what have you. But we used to get fresh meat once in a blue moon. There was a very small amount used to arrive down, fresh frozen meat. But of course the Argentinians like it a lot. Mm-hmm. And so the guy who came back to report, and everybody read out their inventory of what they'd found and how much fuel there was. And when he came to the meat, he said, "Major, there is a very serious situation. We are down to our last 700 kilograms of meat, which would have kept the FIDS bases going for about 20 years, you see. But that was really serious, and the faces got even glummer at that stage.
Final question, if I may. A lot of people who were in the First World War never talked about it.
Mm.
People who were in the Second World War never talked about it. Did you talk about when you got home to Britain and maybe to your girlfriend or your family, did you talk about those 9.5 months? Was there any point?
In general, I did. Yes, yeah. People asked, and I thought if they asked, they were interested. And I realise it was an interesting story. It is an interesting story. Perhaps some of the most difficult times I didn't speak about. But it was different from the army. We were under no... There were no issues of secrecy or, you know, Section D Act or any of those. So that wasn't instilled upon us. And I don't know. It was an interesting story. And it didn't seem like, and I hope it doesn't come across as a moan or a complaint. And I think for many of the people in the war, if they started telling the stories, it could well seem that they were just moaning about how difficult it was. And so they seem to have a natural reticence about it. But I've never had a problem in answering people's questions such as these questions today. No, I've not.
I think a lot of the soldiers didn't talk about it because they didn't want to talk about it because the person listening wouldn't possibly understand.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult for me, in doing this interview now, to really understand what it was like to be incarcerated for 9.5 months.
It is, and it was difficult, but it's still not as bad as people shooting at your pal next year.
Yeah.
And you know, all the blood coming out and all of that. So I did mention the word horror, and that's perhaps a note of an exaggeration, and I would never put it on the same line as being in the trenches.
Was there any humour? Did you survive because of humour?
There was a lot of humour, and the Argentinians were an absolutely brilliant bunch. I couldn't think of a better nation. Their humour was wonderful, and I couldn't thank them for treating us the way that we did. There was a bit of tension between some of them because there were army and there were young men, and I dare say that I can think of one of the army, possibly two, who would be an enthusiastic member of the Guerra Sucia, the dirty war, particularly the deputy base commander. And the students knew what was happening back in their own country. This was at the height of it, you know, when they disappeared, the desparecidos were going. So there was a bit of tension there. But in general, it was a huge amount of humour. I suppose it was helped by the fact that was the year Argentina won the World Cup, La Mundial, and it was played in Argentina, so they could all listen to that on the radio, and we got all quite embroiled in that. And they were great party people. At first, the first sergeant, Sergeant Primero, used to keep the wine under lock and key. And that was partly because we lost a very large amount of it fairly on in the winter. And all the wine was stored in a room, which was kept warm with a heater. And we were all standing outside this room, outside a heater, keeping warm one day, when there was suddenly a huge, huge noise of breaking glass came from inside this room. And a second later, this great flood of wine came, we didn't know what it was because we didn't know the wine was in there, came streaming out from underneath the huge gap that existed underneath all the doors because of the crazy angles the floors and the walls were at, and went rushing down the dirty wooden corridor and froze within a minute or so into this great big long glacier of wine. And the back wall of this had gone too far off vertical and tipped this huge amount, dozens and dozens, hundreds of bottles of wine that had all smashed. So we were on strict rations for the first half of the winter. But then as time went on, we had a party for every single imaginable excuse. So we had parties for the birthdays of girlfriends of the lads who were on base, and they were back in Argentina. So the parties got more and more. So
And they have lots of feast days, you know, and they have Republic Day and Revolution Day and Flag Day and Army Day and Infantry Day and Navy Day. So all these were great big long parties, followed by endless games of the national card game, Truco, which means trick, which is a bit of a bidding game, a bit like bridge. But I got quite good at it because I used to play with one of the Argentinians who spoke English. And it's a with it being a bidding game, you exchange signals and coded signals. And we could do them in English, which we understood. He obviously, and me to a lesser extent, but he understood the other signals, or at least he understood the language. So we got to be quite a good pair because we would play it in English, you see. And those would go on to 6 o'clock in the morning. You can imagine that time got to have no meaning, and it was quite difficult to keep up the regime of getting up in the morning and going to bed at night. You'd lose touch with all of that. So it's an extremely bizarre, topsy-turvy experience. All of those things added together made it into a very, very odd. It was a Franz Kafka experience. It was a crazy house at the fun fair experience. And it was all of that jumbled together. It wasn't all black and it wasn't all light. And it was all at strange angles and strange sounds. And even for somebody who'd done 3 winters in the Antarctic, it was off on another planet of space. This wasn't Antarctica. This was Belgrano.
Thank you very much indeed, Dog, for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Dog, for agreeing to do a bit more with us. I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about your first season at Stonington, which was right at the very end of the dogging period, wasn't it?
It was. My first season was the winter 74. And I and most of the other base members weren't aware that this was going to be the last winter. It's possible somebody was, possible the base commander was, but there was no indication of that. And so I arrived after a good summer season on South Georgia, which was excellent, rather than wandering around on the ship. So arrived in March 74, and like generations of FIDs before me, I took over a team with a few minutes handover and a race around the rocks of Stonington Island from the previous driver of the team. The team was called the Gales, G-A-E-L-S, and it had been driven by a vet beforehand, Bob Bostelman. So I took over, I suppose you could say, a healthy team, and well documented, and Bob had all the inside knowledge of all the dogs as well as his own. So I took over a good team, prosperous team, and at that stage, as I say, we just thought we were one of a long line of dog sledging FIDs, and again we proceeded through the winter with starting with training runs. Because, of course, there were some experienced FIDs there, 4 or 5, who had done at least one season's dog sledging. So the 4 or 5 of us who were new to it were well inducted and well trained. Some of the early trips were quite harrowing with us newcomers, completely out of control, with the dogs dominating and taking us where they wanted to go. So there were a lot of very frustrating moments. It's a tough job learning to drive a dog team, and it's driven many FIDs to frustrating tears, and some of them have never actually got it. It's not something that everybody can do, and you have to work hard at it. So it's extremely strenuous and tiring and often frightening, but extremely rewarding, of course, when you do get it. And like everybody else, I came to love the dogs very, very much, as well as relying on them and appreciating them and admiring them for all their qualities and their resoluteness and their pluckiness.
What work were they doing with you? Because by that time, Stonington area had been quite well serviced, hadn't it?
It was. There's always the odd bit of tie-up to be done, and the odd survey line that needs redoing, or the odd bit of rock that needed to be revisiting. So there's a bit of picking around to be done. There was actually an ongoing scientific work going on Adelaide Island, and 4 FIDs who were supposed to be with us at Stonington had been dropped with their teams at Adelaide Island to do some glaceological work, some geophysical work. And then the plan was that they would join us, sledge across the sea ice and come to Sonnington. So quite a lot of the, I wouldn't say the very earliest days, but as we got into winter, we were expecting the sea ice to form. And so we were going out doing reconnaissances of the glaciers, where the glaciers run down into the sea ice. You tend to get, that's where the ramps of snow form to enable access from the sea ice up to the shore. Because it was always possible that sea ice would form in the area known as the fjords, but not necessarily at Sonnington. So they might have to get onto the onto the inland ice earlier than arriving at Sonnington. So we were doing quite a lot of reconnaissance trips. And of course, as you get into winter and they really start, the cold and the blizzards really start to bite, some of those trips were rugged in the extreme. So I quickly got into my first 10-day lie-up, which became fairly routine. So 10 days confined to the tents, other than going outside for calls of nature or to feed the dogs once a day. So it wasn't much scientific work. Of course, there was a lot of writing up to be done, and people were working on the base. So the scientists that had gathered data the previous summer were still on base, and they were drawing up their maps and writing up their geological notes. So that went on, but the field work was mainly training work, dog training work, and getting us fit.
What was the condition of the ramp? Because by that time, it was beginning to deteriorate, wasn't it?
It was. It was deteriorating. It was narrowing, and it was cracking. It was never so narrow that one was in extreme danger of falling off the edge. But certainly, if you got on a dog team that from the spans that decided it didn't want to go where you wanted to go, which was up the glacier, and it decided they wanted to go back to base, when we were still rookies, the dogs took us where they wanted to go. And so a careering, hurtling descent down a ramp which was seldom covered in decent snow. It was usually bare green bottle, hard bottle ice from the glacier, was a shattering experience. So it was narrow, but we didn't feel that it was going to go any day. It was obviously thinning.
But that presumably added to the stress and strain of trying to get up onto the, well, onto the plateau.
It didn't really, because getting onto the plateau, the dogs were spanned by this time. They were spanned well up onto the northeast glacier. I mean, there were holes right alongside the dog teams. When I cleared up the blubber after a feed, all I had to do was throw it a few feet to the right, the drop into a hole. So the area was badly crevassed. So the ramp wasn't what gave problems for getting access onto the plateau. It was what gave problems on trying to bring the seal feed that we chopped up, trying to get that up the ramp to feed the dogs every couple of days or so. So general access to the teams was the problem.
Mm. And the weather wasn't exactly brilliant.
No. The weather, every few days, another great katabatic blizzard would sweep down off the plateau. You could see wisps of wind and snow begin to come from the plateau 6,000 feet above and 15 miles away. And you knew that was the cold air that had built up at, on the plateau at 7,000 feet would start to tip down the glaciers and could just come roaring down, and we were at the snout of the glacier as it went into the sea. So the wind was very often over 100 miles an hour, rattling everything to blazes. But if you met that when you're in the field, it could make a mess of things. And there were signs of some most astonishing blizzards that we came across. There was an old Argentinian hut turned over and half buried in solid glacier ice at the foot of Soda Bread Slope. And we'd used it and the wind scoop around it to put a depot in ready for our ascent of Soda Bread at the beginning of the summer season. And we lashed big drums of kerosene and lots of man food boxes and dog food boxes, which weigh 50 to 70 pounds, in the wind scoop of this hut. And I personally put in the ice pitons into the ice, and they went in. These were 1 foot long pitons, and they went in absolutely perfectly. So it was as solid as it possibly could. And after one big particular blizzard, where we were camped out not far away, we came to find that the whole hut had disappeared. And I don't know how on earth that was, because it was 6 feet buried in solid ice. And the only sign that there was ever been anything there was one of these ice pitons, these 1 foot long pieces of steel, was bent over at right angles. It was in the ice by about an inch, and there was just a tiny little scrap of rope left. And that was the only indication. 400-pound drums had gone, 70-pound boxes had gone, and this whole hut somehow had been taken out of the ice and scoured out and disappeared. And it had been there for 15, 20 years.
And you never found any remnants?
We never found any remnants whatsoever. And we went searching down the glacier. To, presumably went into holes, but you would have expected to find something here and there. But
when you realised that had happened, did it make you wonder about the security of your own huts?
It made us, not so much about the huts, but it made us wonder about the security of our tents when we were camping, because although they were fantastic tents, one thought, now if we'd been, what it made you feel was fear, I suppose fear, apprehension, because we knew that we were going to have to ascend Soderbred, and that ascent often took a few days to do. I think it took us 3 days, so that was fairly typical. So we would have to be camping at the bottom, and at the middle, and at the top. And so we thought, if one of these blows comes down, these catabatics of that ferocity, which was obviously quite exceptional, then we were goners. And so all the time on the ascent of Soderbred, one, the biggest worry, and of course there were holes and there was steepness and there was ice, steep ice, but the worry was that one of these blows would come when you were committed to it. And as it turned out, we got up without that happening. Although we did have what we used to call a phantom blow. In other words, we saw the drift begin to form above us on the edge of the plateau, and it looked like a blow was starting. And we were all worried stiff and making preparations for this, and then it just dissipated and disappeared. So,
what happened at the end of that season when you left Stonington? Did you, were the dogs still there, or were you taking them out?
What yes, happened? During the summer, during the winter, we got news down from Cambridge that the base was to be closed and that many of the dogs were to be culled. And we had this sort of programme, all dogs over 4 years old were to be culled. So this came down to us like a bolt from the blue, that this was going to be the last season. And as I say, at the beginning of the year, we had no intimation of that whatsoever.
This was an edict from Dick Laws?
This was an edict from, certainly from Cambridge. I can't remember, so I didn't handle the telex or the message myself, but I'm sure, I think it did come from the director, yes.
What was the mood on the base once that telegram had been absorbed?
Shock, anger, puzzlement, all of that. These days you would say it seemed to be taken without consultation. perhaps we weren't the best people to ask, but it came like a bolt out of the blue. There was no real explanation as to why, and there is in fact some logic behind the decision, not necessarily the decision at, precisely at that time, but the way the survey and the work was changing and the planes and everything else were improving. And the state of the work that had been done, much of the broad brush work had been done over the whole of Grahamland, and the more concentrated work lent itself better to the modern style. I'm not making excuses. As I say, there was a logic, but the decision when it came had none of that explanation. And we were shocked and furious and sad, but determined to make a good go of the last season for the dogs and for us. So
tell me about dealing with the dogs then. Did it occur to you to ignore that instruction?
No, I don't think it did occur. I didn't hear any of that on base. We weren't really in control of it. At the end of the summer season, we would be picked up by an aeroplane and taken back to a base, and some of the lads would go home. So no, we couldn't have sort of gone out and lived in the wilderness on our own. And we had several months. In fact, from when we got the news, it was probably about 9 or 10 months later by the time the dastardly deed was done.
And how was that deed conducted?
All the field parties that were in southern Grahamland, or central Grahamland at the time, were brought back to Fossil Bluff as a staging post before being flown north back to Adelaide, which was the airbase at the time. And we all had our teams with us, obviously. And
so you've been transported from Stonington to Fossil Bluff with dogs?
We'd left Stonington in August time. Left August at the end of the winter, sledged up Soderbred. We'd gone to our work areas and secondary work areas and done work for 2 or 3 months until the planes arrived on the peninsula. And then the planes came down and flew the various parties down to southern Grahamland, which was further south, and that was where most of the outstanding work was still to be done.
So the dogs went too?
So the dogs went with us, yes. And that was the normal way of things then. In other words, there were sort of two work areas. There was one you went to and filled in whilst waiting for the planes, and then once the planes came, then the summer season got into full swing. And so there were quite a number of sledges all working within a large area, but what could be generally called central or southern Grahamland. So they brought us back to Fossil Bluff, and by then we knew which dogs were to go. As I say, it was all dogs over four, with what I think one or two exceptions were made for one or two outstanding leaders that were allowed, because they of course can train other dogs. But the general rule was, it was a bit like Herod's, all children under two were to be slaughtered, while all dogs over four were. And there were a few younger dogs actually went as well, the dogs that either weren't so very good or weren't very well or something. So they arrived back. We were offered the option by Steve Wormold, who had come down as summer operations manager, and he was a dog sledging fit from Stonington beforehand. But we were given the option by him that he would kill the dogs, or the drivers would kill the dogs. He didn't want to take them off us if we wanted to do the deed. I think the vast majority of people asked him to do it, which wasn't very nice for him, but it would have been clearly much more difficult for drivers to want to shoot their own dogs. Of course, we had to do it at times when we were in the field and dogs got too old or too badly injured, so we'd all had to kill a dog, but that was for a different reason, just the fact that it was over four. So we left all the dogs, we left half the dogs or three quarters of the dogs at Fossil Bluff, and then most of us wanted to get out. So we flew out with our remaining teams, the remnants of our teams and sledges, back to Adelaide, and Steve and possibly one or two others spent an unpleasant day or two having to shoot a large number of dogs.
So three quarters of the dogs gathered at Fossil Bluff approximately were put down?
Yes.
And you weren't there to see it happen?
No.
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 And the gun was used rather than injection?
Yes, the gun was used, I think, because of the numbers involved. I dare say, I wouldn't like to state too dogmatically, because there may have been some that were done by injection. But injection was a bit slow, and it was quite difficult. You had to shave the dog's leg and keep the dog quiet, find the vein. If it was cold, the fluid would freeze and things. So whilst we used to do that in certain very controlled conditions, and in some ways it was better, a .303 rifle was the most effective way.
I would imagine it would leave a bitter taste in your mouth at the end of your first year as a FID.
It did, very, very much so. As that summer season drew to a close, and we'd all been out for 6 months with the dogs, and of course the bond by then was extremely close, and we'd had a magnificent, wonderful time. And you knew that as days went by, half of these wonderful animals were getting closer to death. So it was. It hung very heavily over us, and I still think some of us didn't even believe it was going to happen, that there'd be some change of policy. But no, indeed, it happened, and we were all extremely downcast. And all the surviving dogs knew precisely what was going on.
Really?
Yes. The dogs knew very well when one of their fellows was to be taken away to be shot. They could feel it in our thoughts. Just like dogs now often know their masters and what they're thinking and what they're going to do, they have the intuition that nature's bred in them. So if a dog was to be culled, the rest of the dogs would go very quiet before the event.
Hours before?
No, minutes, several minutes before. But right. It wasn't that they saw you waving a gun around or anything like that. They knew something was up, and they go very quiet and avert your gaze in case they were the one to be picked. And I remember once, after when I had a dog to be culled in the field, I went to dig a... We were in completely open country with no shelter or no crevasse or no mountain or no known attack. So I went 100 yards away and began to dig a wall so I could take the dog behind it and shoot it there rather than in full view of everywhere. As I went away and started to dig this sort of little igloo thing, all the dogs started to howl at me because they were all watching me do this. And then, having done that, I walked back and I got the dog concerned and put him on the trace to walk him over, and the dog started howling again as I walked him over, and they all faced away and averted their gaze in case they were next.
And did the dog in question try and resist?
Yes.
So he knew as well?
Yes, he knew, and then gave up resisting and walked rather downcastly to be shot.
What did that do to the trust between dog and human?
Yes, that's a very good point. The dogs were a bit shifty for a while after things like that had happened. But again, like everything else, they would bounce back. I didn't see any real overt change in behaviour. They didn't all start barking at me, or they were still friendly, but not for a while. It took them a little while to get over the fact.
So there was quite a bond, even though they would fight tooth and claw, there was quite a bond between the dogs.
Yes, indeed, yeah. They'd fight like blazes to start with, but once you've been out in the field a bit, they tended to calm down. They'd had their exercise, and they were working hard. Every now and then a fight would break out if a bitch was on heat or there was some particular reason, but in general, once you've been away from base for a while and the dogs had got a couple of fights out of the system, they'd settle down. You could go for quite a long time without too much trouble. But other than that, they were, you might say, they were great friends. There was a bond between them and they worked together as a team.
So when it came to the Fossil Bluff cull and some dogs were put on the plains and some weren't,
yes,
would they have known then what was going
on? Oh, yes. Oh, they knew that. They knew because you were splitting the dogs and leaving some behind. And they were very, very subdued. The behaviour of the dogs was extremely subdued. They weren't,
but not rebellious.
They weren't jumping around. No, not rebellious. Just subdued is the way I can put it. Instead of being the usual jumping around and barking and excited, particularly in an area like that when there's a lot of teams around, there's a lot of people and there's planes and everything happening, the dogs love that sort of activity. So they're normally jumping like blazes on the end of the traces. Mm. So no, they all went.
And I realise that this is a subjective question. You can only give a personal subjective reply. But do you think that the dogs, when they were being divided, some to fly and some not to fly, did they just know they were being divided and didn't like that, or did they know what the ultimate consequence was going to be?
Again, they knew something was up.
Yeah.
Because this was unusual behaviour for us to do that sort of thing. So they would sense. Unusual behaviour is something that dogs, which are the most conservative of animals, don't like. Yeah. Yes.
You had to work with dogs again, of course, at Adelaide.
Well, yes, we were still left. We were left after the cull. We were left with 52 dogs, and of course, Stonington had been closed whilst we were away from it, so we didn't go back to Stonington. All our belongings had been left there and marked, and were waiting for us when we flew back to Adelaide base.
So somebody did a pickup.
Yes,
so the removal men had been in.
The ship had been in, and the base was closed and Genghis Wright was had to be flown out of the field to conduct that closure, and so they took everything that was needed, including our belongings, back to Adelaide base, so that was waiting for us, yeah. But so we still had teams, and we managed to put together, out of the 52 dogs, we put together four teams, and of course these were younger dogs, so these were dogs below the age of four. So they were fit and strong, and we got some good teams out of it. And by then, the four of us with teams were experienced. We'd had a year sledging. And so my second winter at Adelaide base, we did some terrific sledging, and we were blessed with a fantastic sea ice year. Whereas the year before, when we needed some sea ice to get these lads back, we hadn't had any. But we had a terrific sea ice year, so particularly with my future brother-in-law, I did some wonderful trips, and that was great to be able to have the dogs. And it wasn't that, well, these dogs will last another couple of years and then they will have to be put down. It hadn't been said that. It said, you've got 50 dogs, you know, carry on using them during the winter, but not in the summer. So during that winter, as well as taking dogs out, we had to do trips with the new skidoos and start to develop techniques, to safety techniques and sledging techniques for the skidoo,
which we talked about earlier.
Yes, that's right.
So the dogs really. Why weren't the dogs used in the summer then? The snow was too soft, or?
No, it's because the summer seasons, which were the when the vast majority of scientific work was done, was to go over to the new methods, which were using skidoos, shorter summer seasons. So instead of scientists wintering. And writing up their previous summer's work, preparing for the next one. Scientists used to generally do two and a half years like the rest of us. But the new method was that scientists wouldn't winter, because that was a waste of salary and a waste of their time and stuff. They would always go back to Cambridge then and come back down. To be fair, if you're going to adopt a method like that, you can't suddenly fly a scientist in and say, there's a dog team, we're out in the field tomorrow. So that's why another reason the time had come for the dogs, because of the new method. But you could give them a skidoo and I'd say, sit on that and press that button and we're off tomorrow into the field.
I just want to spend a couple of minutes, if I may, with you, Dog, talking about your first year at Rotherham, because you were the first winter base commander at Rotherham.
Well,
am I right?
Not quite, because
things never that easy.
That sounds rather strange. No, for Adelaide's last year, Adelaide base last year, there was a sort of advance party living in a small hut, just like the old days, a very small hut, in fact, about as big as a carpenter's shed, doing meteorology and if you like, preparing the ground, though not necessarily literally, but stationed at Rotherham for that summer. For that winter. Mm-hmm. So that was an advance party, but there'd been no construction work or anything of that sort, just this little hut was put there. And so Brian Sheldon was there in that little advance base as a base commander. So it's a bit like Fossil Bluff, really, the four of them. So, but then the following, the summer of 1976-77, the big construction work came in, and that was the start of Rotherham is now, and some of the buildings are still there. But the concept of Rotherham began then as a major air base with modern methods and modern buildings and two stories, and using it very much as a summer camp, an intensive summer camp. That's where the concept had come, which the Antarctic Surveyor developed at that time. Steve Wormald was very much involved with that as a concept, and people like Alan Smith, who are here this weekend, also very much involved. So that's when Rotherham, as we know it now, began, not just as a series of huts or buildings, as a concept.
But you were the first base commander to do a proper winter.
That's right.
But even so, you weren't necessarily sleeping in huts.
No, we weren't, because it was a very, very big building operation, far greater than anything that had happened at that time. Very large buildings. And so there's an awful lot left undone when the summer season ended and the big parties all went home, and there were 11 of us left, and the basic buildings had been put up, but there'd been no fitting inside. And so we had an extremely hard working winter in fitting out and painting and preparing the huts. And these were huge huts designed to house 70 odd people in for the summer, and yet there were only 11 of us to do the work, and we still have to live. So that was very intensive. But until mid-winter, we hadn't been able to prepare the inside of the huts to sleep in. So we were living in tents at the time. The cooking was being done indoors, but not the sleeping. So that was hard work that winter. And of course, all FIDs would say all winters are hard work, but I know several winters, and that was an absolute corker on that first base.
So it was possible to sleep in a tent in the winter in the Antarctic?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, we and many of us spent many months in the field in the winter anyway. We had wonderful double sleeping bags. Most of the time in the summer, you only ever needed to use a single skin. So they were well set up for it. Winter sledging was a bit slower. The ice would build up inside the tents, and if you your water would freeze, and if you couldn't make your porridge to soak because the water would freeze, and you had to go very carefully in the morning, letting the heat of the primus and the tilly lamp melt all the condensation off the inside of the tent. And of course you had to be careful with the cold on your hands and feet when you're outside. So everything was a bit slower. But once you got going, it was great. The days were short, but we weren't at extreme southerly latitude. So the days were short, but it was never pitch black around Marguerite Bay. So you were sledging in, if it was a nice day, you were sledging in beautiful sort of alpenglow. It was permanent sunrise, or you could say permanent sunset, with the sun just below the horizon, but lighting things up with beautiful colours.
One final thought, have you been back to Rothera since, or you must have seen photographs of it?
I did actually go back. I was one of the cruisers in 2005, and we went back, and I recognised the layout, and the main living quartered hut still then was built on the basis of what we'd done, and they just extended it. I didn't enjoy the experience in the slightest of going back to Rothera. I found it rather depressing and soulless. And of course the whole of the system had changed anyway, so things such as everybody with their own specific task to do rather than everybody mucking in together as we'd been used to. So to have, you know, specialist French cooks and construction companies down there rather than the FIDs doing it, I thought rather took the fun out of it. Although, I appreciate why, from a scientific and a business point of view, why that makes sense. But from a personal experience and the general camaraderie that FIDs bases had above perhaps anything else other than maybe the services, then all that had been lost. To actually open the door and find somebody on an exercise bike, the thought that you needed to keep fit by going on an exercise bike, as I think about it every day, it's still shocking, because to say we got plenty of exercise outside was the understatement of the year. So that sort of thing didn't go down. So I suppose I had some pride in Rothera that we'd done, and I had pride at the end of that winter that a small band of men had achieved such a huge amount to get this thing ready for the next summer season when the planes came in. And we had this wonderful gleaming new base and generators all working. And when the planes came down, bingo, it was there, and all the beds were ready and stuff. And that had taken a phenomenal amount of work over many, many months. So that was some pride, and it was nice to see it still there, and the layout, and as I say, the concept of it, that we'd started that. So, good.
Dog, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome, Chris. Thanks.